Here the mind reaches out to select its favorite objects, or to pursue some special occupation, art, or science, or it displays itself in mediocrity, indifference, or incapacity for learning. And the last of the developments of mind that constitute the group which I have classified as five great elements of reason, is man's spirituality, and this is manifest in the deep yearnings of religion, tendering to reverence, fear, awe, worship, aspiration, and finally to inspiration, which in its normal action on the human soul, is the voice of God inbreathed in the mind of man. In all these five departments, namely, the sensual, affectional, moral, intellectual, and spiritual elements of mind, there are corresponding organs seated in the brain, each endowed with its separate and peculiar functions. The sensual part of man's nature must be guided and regulated by addresses by EHB8, knowledge, or it degenerates into excess, which is crime. Even so, must the moral and other tendencies in human nature be ruled. In fact, in every department there must be a power which rules the proclivities of mind arrayed at its tribunal. We call that power reason. It requires for its perfect exercise, first, the harmonious working of all the elements of mind, next, the knowledge to discriminate and judge amongst them. Reason comprehends and speculates, and judgment legislates and passes verdicts on the faculties of mind, and hence we find that sanity is an equal development of all man's mental faculties. Wherever one or other is deficient, there is insanity, or unsoundness. You may not recognize it, unless it manifests itself in some extreme, but I say that every crime and every proclivity to excess which is, indeed the essence of crime, is more or less insanity. Any tendencies which become dangerous to humanity are as much insanity as the passion known as frenzy, excessive madness, or that which is recognized as such, and demands the restraint of physical force, is only the excessive plus or minus of some organ of the brain, resulting in inequality of balance between the various functions of the mind. So long as there is even a partial equilibrium amongst all the mental faculties, whilst the sensual nature is restrained by others, when the stern, strict sense of morality does not lead the mind into fanaticism, so long as the affections do not run riot, or the intellect absorbs the being to the exclusion of the rest, or the spiritual yearnings of the soul wrong not material duties, just so long as there is an equal balance amongst all these various tendencies, the result is mental health or sanity. But even the least disturbance of these mental forces, a predominance or lack of either element resulting in lack of balance amongst the whole, is, in its degree, insanity. Anatomy records that in many cases where insanity prevails, especially in such instances as appear traceable to cerebral excitement, there is often no evidence of anatomical change in the brain. The brains of lunatics, in post-mortem examinations, are not unfrequently found in a healthful state, although there is almost invariably discovered physical disorganization in some other portion of the frame, especially of the great nervous center, the spine. Insanity, too, is often promoted by a deterioration of some portions of the system apart from the brain, every part of the wonderful structure of humanity being so intimately connected, that any organic disturbance is calculated to produce the abnormal condition called insanity. I call insanity, then, the want of equilibrium in the entire system, which localizes an injury, in want of balance amongst the various organs of the brain, for though this state may be produced by physical causes, these causes ultimately represent themselves, through the system, upon the mind, and therefore in the brain, as the throne room of the sovereign mind. And the demon of insanity finds there its exhibition. Our question further adds, what are its purposes? In the divine economy there is but one purpose subserved by suffering, mental or physical, and this is, to teach us to know ourselves, to warn us to legislate among our faculties, and to guard well the noble structure of the physical form, which in disorganization presses too rudely on the mind, and to avoid the dangerous excesses which, in mind, is crime, in matter, disease and death. In the economy of the human system you may trace all its defects, either from hereditary tendencies, accident, disease, or some disturbance in the nervous system. I believe with Hahnemann, that there is a spiritual cause for all disease, and that when he can produce and equalize the perfect flow of life's electric currents, there will be no disease, and in this state there can be no cerebral disturbance called insanity. The purpose, if we may conceive that God designs a special purpose in insanity, is only to be subserved by studying the human system, by considering carefully those addresses by EHB9, causes which produce inequality or want of equilibrium in the brain, and foremost amongst the subjects of this fell disease I call as criminals. To my mind, all crimes and moral obliquities are insanity. To me it seems that evil tendencies are not alone ignorance of the highest good and the highest wisdom, but that they originate in most instances in some physical or mental state, induced by physical or inherited deformities, the sins of the father visited upon the children, and that in these inherited tendencies, the inequality that produces crime is insanity. We do wrong only to visit the causes of insanity upon those who are restrained for the safety of the public in lunatic asylums. The only madmen are not the raving maniacs. To study the worst species of insanity, we should visit the prisons, jails, and penitentiaries. To deal with these as physicians rather than magistrates, we should convert our prisons into moral hospitals, and infirmaries for sick souls. Then, and then only, shall we realize what insanity is, and how it may be cured. Lunacy is the want of balance only between any of those five functions which I have thus hastily classed as constituting all the assembled faculties of mind. When reason and judgment can legislate, fairly amongst these, there is perfect sanity. When there is a want of balance from any cause originating either in physical disorganization, or excessive predominance of one mental faculty over another, that state is insanity. Question 5. What do you understand to be the conditions necessary to admit of mediums being lifted in the air, and of the passage of spirits through material objects, if they can so pass? Answer. The condition for the elevation of any body from the ground is counter-attraction. All things are held in their place upon this earth by the power of gravitation, that is the one sole power that draws to the common center the entire of the beings that remain upon the round moving world. Any power that can overcome the earth's gravitation, whether it be the mechanical power that enables us to lift an object, or that which causes the lodestone to suspend a certain weight of iron, or any power corresponding to the power of the lodestone, any force, in fact, that will overcome the gravitation of the earth, can upheave the heaviest body from the earth. Now, there is a power of magnetism, within that which is the strongest magnet in creation, namely, the human form, which, when the spirit is liberated from matter, and, by a knowledge of chemistry, is enabled so to compose the elements which emanate from a mediumistic body, together with those which are held in solution in atmospheric air, as to form a strong and powerful magnet, or lodestone, which can upheave substances in air. This phenomenon is but the result of the spirit's and the medium's vital magnetism, or the act itself is but a result of that same force which upheaves in this imponderable ether the vast bulk of the mighty sun, and revolving satellites. All these are held in space by attraction and counterattraction. The centripetal force which draws you to the center of the earth is overcome by a centrifugal force, which sends lighter bodies from the earth. Now, between these two forces in operation, there is an inevitable inequality. There is in all things in nature addresses by EHB10, lack of equilibrium which produces alternating movements between the forces of attraction and repulsion. To produce the phenomena of which you ask, we must overcome the attraction of Earth's gravitation, and thus we can upheave the mightiest bodies in space. Spirits are but experimenting in the present phase of spiritual phenomena. They are, like yourselves, learning the exhibition of the rudiments of the science of magnetism, and the very simplest of these is the power which enables them to form a magnet of mediumistic and atmospheric essences, and where they have a good battery in the person of the medium who must be highly negative to their positive force, it is one of the simplest of the phenomena of spiritualism to upheave that negative body in the air. Your question concerning spirits passing through material obstacles involves another set of laws entirely. We must ask leave to enter a little more into detailed notice of the subject, and remind you that we requested the permission of this audience, some 6 weeks since, to deliver in this place a course of lectures. We did not aim in this to produce mere oratorical effects, but to give through our medium's best capacity the rudiments of a philosophy on that philosophy, time, study, and spiritual growth will add great superstructures. But it will not remove the basis. A portion of that philosophy related to the question, what is spirit? And in rendering the answer, we stated that spirit lived in accordance with a set of laws in no respect analogous to those which govern matter. We urged that spirit transcends all the laws of matter, and that there is no law which rules or governs matter that belongs to a spiritual existence. One of the laws of matter which spirit transcends is that of time and space. We now ask leave to enter upon the question more in full. Time is the boundary of material movements only, there is no time in eternity. But there are periods occupied by certain changes of matter. The changes, for instance, between the sun and this earth, are affected in a certain period of eternity which we call time, and marked by night and day, seasons and years. We find that when material forms are moved in any direction, they require a period in eternity to effect the change. One of the attributes of matter is called impenetrability, but in reality this attribute does not exist, for though you may pierce the very hardest crystal, you still find spaces within it, and still no one atom of matter can occupy the space that is occupied by another atom. The boundary of material forms, then, is that which constitutes space, but these are the laws of matter, not of spirit, for spirit occupies no space, and spirit lives not in time. And this I must illustrate by calling to your remembrance the late address on Hades. Therein it was declared that the spirit outworks from itself its own light or darkness, and therefore makes its own night or day. Cold and heat are also outwrought from the morale of spiritual nature, and hence it is that disembodied souls reside in their own atmosphere, which to them is summer of winter, according to their nature. Hence, all darkness, light, season, and time, is of the spirit's creation. Periods in eternity are needed for spirit's progress, but the extent or limit of that period is dependent on the spirit's energy in working out its progress. Hence the bitter season of spiritual cold and spiritual winter may be through countless ages, since it must endure until the frozen heart outworks the latent heat of a moral summer, and the period of summer is the already sunny soul of spiritual love and kindness, an ever-lengthening never-ending summer day of eternity. So there is no time in the spirit world. And as the spirit has no density, no weight, and is lighter than all things in creation, so it occupies no space. Your physical bodies are heavier than the ether in which you move, than the water on which you sail, or than the mold on which you tread. Thus addresses by EHB 11, you are the very reverse of the spirit, which is lighter than its world, its atmosphere, or scenery, and thus as unobstructed as the lightest of all elements, it passes through all obstacles of matter. As the finer permeates the grosser, so does spirit permeate all things. Were your eyes open like the seers of old, and could you perceive the various spheres of spirit life, you might see them penetrating each other, and spirits of the finer passing through the very forms and spheres of spirits yet more gross, even passing through them, for pure spirit has no analogy whatsoever with matter, and therefore matter is no obstacle to it. You may say, indeed, that spirit is not ubiquitous, and that in passing from point to point it must occupy time and move through space. I reply, no. All movement in spirit land is effected by will. According to the energy of that will does the spirit pass from point to point. True, there are points in infinity, as there are periods in eternity, but the spirit's will overcomes all these. So if the will is energetic, the space exists not, the spirit is where it would by will be. If the will is languid, or if there be counter-attractions to its exercise, the spirit pauses, its will is not strong enough to project itself more swiftly than the moving elements around it, and so it seems to pass through space. And in response to the last part of your question, I answer, the spirit world is here, nor needs your open door, nor unroofed ceiling, nor aught of material form removed to permit the entrance of the unfettered spirit. Spirit world and life and presence are already here. Spirit is fine and subtle, boundless and transcendent even as thought. You realize no obstacles to thought, and thought is the attribute, and the only attribute that can be comprehended in this world of matter of true spiritual being. The material forms and substances that spirits take on themselves, when clothed with magnetic matter they strive to telegraph to man through the phenomena of the spirit circle, are the clothings of atmosphere and mediumistic emanations, and these, though infinitely sublimated, being compared to spirit still as substance, occupy space, and are definite in form. Nevertheless, no obstacle that you can present, not the sword that superstition wields against the apparition, not the bullet that may be fired, the stick with which one strikes, or the hand that passes through the substance of the spirit, can in truth affect it. It is the pure essence of things, while matter is their gross external covering. The laws of these opposing elements do not cohere. I shall conclude this question by merely reminding you of one fact patent amongst yourselves, and that is the experience of the somnambulist. You find, in the waking state, that you are constantly fearful of falling from heights, and the power of gravitation exerted by the earth upon your physical form, drawing you to the common center, compels you to steer your way carefully in order to prevent your fall in obedience to this force of gravitation. But far otherwise is it with the somnambulist. Unconscious of the presence of a physical body, the spirit and its consciousness alone being awake, the spiritual nature and its laws triumph over the nature and laws of the material body. It realizes no gravitation, feels no weight, therefore it passes along the dizzy heights of precipices and stupendous steeps unconscious of its danger, and therefore rarely falling, never indeed, unless the depth of the somnambulic sleep is disturbed by accident. As gravitation only acts between matter and matter, spirit is not obedient to its force, and the somnambulic state is one of its most familiar illustrations. Addresses by EHB 12, Question 6. Will you explain the law of faith as a practical principle of life? Answer: with permission, we will materialize your question. We claim that faith is knowledge. Wheresoever faith exists, it is the spirit's knowledge of that which is. True faith is in reality the soul's perception of truth. It is often demanded as an act of volition that the mind shall manifest faith, but you do not represent to that mind what are the antecedent facts which constitute the knowledge which ensures faith. There can be no faith within the human soul, which is not the result of a manifestation of some realized truth. Take, for example, the faith required by the gracious master for the performance of cures. It is represented even by the followers of Christ, that he could not in some places perform the cures he did in others, because of the lack of faith of those who appealed to him for aid. It is claimed in sacred history that his greatest cures were performed upon those who asked not even for the touch of his healing hand, or the contact of his garments, but had a faith which perceived that the cure was with him, and demanded alone his exercise of will. What was this faith? It was the knowledge that he could effect a cure. So a true faith existing in the human soul is always a perception of a truth. It may not be an actual truth in nature, but it is a truth to the perception of that soul which feels its movement, and thus faith may exist in error as well as in truth. Faith is often what you call mere blind belief and is then founded upon fanaticism. Faith is often the tendril of the soul that outreaches to grasp some shadow which it mistakes for substance, but it is the perception of a fancied truth in the soul, which constitutes true faith. There are spiritual truths which illustrate faith far better than that which we have alluded to, for faith is the substance of things unseen, and such is man's faith in immortality. Such in part is our confident trust in God, or even in the love of friends. Faith alone, it must be, that realizes the protection of an all-wise heavenly Father, faith that believes God is our Father. Mark the faith of the poor ignorant savage who prays to the Manitou of whom no Bible, gospel or creed has taught him. Remember man's faith in the true and beautiful which enables him still to go on conquering the spirit of destructiveness of which we spoke in the earlier part of the evening, and still to do battle for the right even in the midst of all earth's cruel blows leveled against his work. What is it but faith that carries us onward to the unseen realms of immortality, still striving for the prize we have not seen, the goal we have never known? Faith in God is the action of the grand divine magnet himself, the action of God in the universe, who by faith is ever calling us upward to Him. I ask not for faith in aught which is not a truth to the individual whom I would convince. The objects I should lay before him whom I would convince, should seem to me to be some comprehensive truth. If the mind of my client cannot perceive this truth, I ask in vain for faith is like the reason and judgment of which I spoke in the definition of insanity. It is the culminating point of mind, the soul's perception of what that soul believes to be the truth and nothing but the truth. Hence faith is indeed the spiritual substance of things unseen, the knowledge of that which the spirit feels as truth. Mr. Coleman proposed a vote of thanks to Miss Harding, which was unanimously carried. Addresses by EHB 13, Miss Harding, permit me to say a few words in reply. Although my inspiration must fail me as far as the power of oratory is concerned, it will at least be prompted by the sentiments of truth. You are doubtless aware, many of you, that I am of English birth, but you will also remember the words of the poet, that, we live in heart throbs, not in figures on the dial. Therefore during my 10 years' residence in America, English though I am, I lived so very quick, and my heart throbs in that great land of the West were so rapidly repeated, that I believe I have lived more than thrice told the number of years in events in that country. Consequently, when I returned, I felt far more like a stranger among you than one who had never trod your shores except in the facts of history or tradition. I had forgotten my country's institutions and perhaps in some respects, many of my country's customs. The best effort that I could make to serve the cause of spiritualism I felt was due, for to me it is my life. I had been spiritually born in America since my departure from England, and I felt I never could make sacrifices enough for that which had brightened my way and been a lamp to my feet, an angel presence in all my wanderings, and these have been very far, sometimes amounting to thousands and thousands of miles in one single year, yet at every footfall the power of the Spirit was about and with me. I went where the Spirit voice bade me. I never took a step, nor fulfilled an engagement that was not sanctified by the voice of one whom men called dead, and I never passed from point to point where my path was not illuminated and made straight for me by those whom the world say are not. In obedience to the voice of this dear invisible host, I had determined to make my short visit to England, although it was necessarily one of business, one of spiritual effort also. You may remember, or you may have heard, that we have 5 millions of spiritualists in America, and that our ranks are divided into societies which are recognized by the laws of the country. And as union is strength, so the existence of these societies enables the spiritualists to extend their sphere of usefulness in many ways besides providing hospitable homes, arranging meetings, and focalizing interests about their mediums, which places them very much in the position of priests, and sometimes as in my case, amongst the dear Americans almost as an idol in their midst, for truly their love was sometimes worship and there was and is a deep devotion in the ties that bind the people to their mediums, that fills our hearts with love and designates me as their Emma, they, as my peculiar people. I have found their hearts, their arms, and homes ever open to receive me, and in all these they have enshrined me with so much tenderness, and with such a vast amount of that faith of which the spirits have been talking, that it seemed to me I had almost forgotten myself, my country, and that country's very widely differing institutions. So when I came to England, where I find that spiritualism stands upon another basis, and in the exceeding wisdom of the spirits has reached a different class of mind to those who constitute Americans' millions, I was sad, disappointed, and perhaps impatient. It seemed to me that the long habits of my ministry in past days were closed against me. I had been accustomed frequently to visit the prisons, the dens of vice, the hospitals, and even the woeful battlefield. I had been called upon to labor for the poor, and take part in charitable movements, and every Sunday to sanctify spiritualism by the blessed name of religion, and to perform 2 Sabbath services to our people. All this was so very dear to me, and gave me the feeling of leading a life of such exceeding usefulness, that here I felt almost lost. I thought I could do no good amongst you, and I longed for the springtime to come that would send me back to a life of very great labor, but with all a very great usefulness. I could not see in what addresses by EHB-14 direction I could be of service here, for where I found an opening for giving spiritual lectures, it appeared to me to involve such a great amount of responsibility on my part, to which I was not accustomed, and such a heavy tax upon my own limited means, for which I had no provision, that I felt it was almost impossible thus for me to begin life afresh. Then it was, that, in obedience to the kind invitation of our good chairman, who has been to me more like a father than a mere friend in this crisis, simply to please him, because I felt so very grateful to the ever warm hand that had been stretched out to greet the stranger before he knew whether I was to be successful or not, simply, I say, in response to his kind invitation, I came amongst you for the first time. You remember the opening night of these meetings? With me my presence was an act of personal friendship, as I stated. Before I left this stand, I felt that the masses I had left behind me were compensated for in the quality of that which I that night addressed. I felt that I had stood within a noble circle of appreciative minds, minds which fully realized the truth and worth of spiritualism in its higher and grander phases, as a prophecy of what is yet to come. I had spoken to the comfortless and sorrowful, I had lectured much to those who live so fast that they have no time to reflect upon the future, but only stoop to gather the flowers of the present hour. Here, however, I was speaking to the stern old British heart and brain, to that which digests philosophy and ultimates it in the slow and inevitable course of a progress that the ages cannot uproot. I felt all this realization crowding upon me the first night I was amongst you, and then my homesick longing for the dear land of the West became gradually appeased, and I felt it was a privilege to be amongst you, that although my usefulness to spirits in prison might scarcely be called into play here, I could gather strength from you, learn philosophy by intuition, and realize phases of spiritual life, which have often failed me when I alone was the giver and all about me were recipients. I have begun to change places amongst you, and realize an inspiration, for which I heartily and gratefully thank you all. Our ministrations have not been long together, but I have already learned to feel not as if you are my people, but my friends, my support, my counselors, and that we are walking together up the steps of that mysterious temple, on whose threshold we are standing, and which, when we have purified ourselves and practiced knowledge till we have made it deeds, we may hope to be permitted to enter. This is my relation to you. Now I am about to enter upon another experiment, but one which I contemplated from the standpoint of my American experience, rather than my knowledge of this country. I thought it was but to present myself to the public as of old, and I should certainly be received at least with candor, and be enabled to present myself in most of my arrangements as I had done in America. In this, however, I have been grievously deceived. I find that in this great Babylon of London there is so much preliminary effort required and such a vast amount of responsibility to be undertaken, that I have already shrunk back again and again from the effort I contemplated, and nothing but the strength and confidence which your outstretched hands have given me could induce me to go on even for one lecture on my own account. It is already now determined that that lecture shall be given. It is an experiment, perhaps too rashly entered into in view of its financial arrangements which are overwhelming. Nevertheless it has been, like all other movements of mine, the word of the spirits. It has been given to me months and months ago to present to you a picture of the land I have traversed. I have no fear of my undertaking as far as that success, which in Spiritland is motive, rather than human results, is concerned. I have acted from the motives of the deepest gratitude to those who have sent me forth and guarded me with the wall addresses by EHB-15, of Spirit Fire. The spirits bade me lecture. The spirits bade MS stand before a large public audience here, and tell the English public what should be given me to say about America. It matters not whether I speak to those who politically may have been opposed to my course or not. God's truth and the spirits' mode of rendering it know no politics, no sect or section. The chief success, if I may venture so to state it, of any political efforts which I have been privileged to make, has been because those efforts have been made from the standpoint of principles and not of politics. Now I have no fear of addressing you, though I love you so dearly, every one of you, that I feel that my lips should be seared before I should speak the words of unwelcome truths to you, or even tread hastily upon your prejudices, but I have no fear of doing this. I am going to speak God's truth so far as wise spirits can give it me to say, and my own humble obedience to them can render it.